Welcome to the Opium Den interviews. My name is Daniel Williams. Today is August the 12th, 2010, and we're going to reach across the pond, as they say, to merry old England and speak with Dr. Sue Blackmore. Dr. Blackmore is a well-known and well-regarded individual over there in Great Britain. She is a freelance writer, she's a lecturer, and a broadcaster over in the UK. Sue is the author of over 60 academic articles and numerous books, which include Beyond the Body, Dying to Live, In Search of the Light, and her most recent work is titled 10 Zen Questions. And Sue has a degree in psychology and parapsychology from Oxford in 1973. And she received her PhD in parapsychology from the University of Surrey in 1980. She's a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth. And as I mentioned, she is a well-known and well-regarded individual over there in Great Britain. So she is a authority on a number of levels, and why we're going to speak with her today is that Dr. Blackmore is an outspoken critic of drug prohibition, and she believes, as we do here inside the Opium Den, that drug prohibition should be repealed. And what we're going to talk about today with Dr. Blackmore is we're going to talk about a couple of drugs, the hallucinogens, specifically LSD, and we're going to talk about MDMA. Both of these drugs have a very popular following in the culture. We're going to take a little bit of a detour with regards to the recreational use of these substances, and we're going to talk about how LSD and MDMA can help in the spiritual side of life with folks who are afflicted with terminal diseases and have that easily understood fear of dying and what comes next from that. So we're going to talk about how LSD and MDMA could work in those areas. And we're looking forward to talk to Dr. Blackmore with regards to that. So what we're going to do here, we're going to fire up the Skype machine, and we're going to give Dr. Sue Blackmore a call. So I've been looking forward to this interview. I've read a lot of what Dr. Blackmore has written. She seems to be a very interesting lady, and I'm hoping that all of the listeners here inside the Opium Den will agree with me on that. So let's fire up the Skype machine and cross the Atlantic.
Hello.
Well, hello, Dr. Blackmore. Daniel Williams, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I know it's 5 o'clock over there in merry old England, and it's only noon here in Southwest Florida, but we appreciate you taking the time to join us inside the Opium Den and talk about drugs, our favorite subject here.
I look forward to it. Well, I'm just having my favorite English drug, a nice strong cup of tea.
Ah, well, do you have sugar and cream, or do you take it straight?
No, milk, not cream.
Milk,
no sugar, and very strong. In America, you can't get proper tea because no Americans seem to realize you have to have exactly boiling water. It has to be actually boiling when it goes on the tea to extract all the powerful drugs that give you the kind of, you know, the tannin and the caffeine and all the other things that give you a wonderful mental buzz.
So is it
an addiction, really?
Well, we all have our poisons.
Yeah, so, a fairly harmless one.
Yeah, I didn't know that brewing tea was such an art. But if
absolutely.
What brand of tea are you drinking today?
Oh, what we call builder's tea. That's a general English name for very strong black tea. I don't even know what make it is. It's just, you know, black and strong, no fancy stuff.
Are you a tea, no coffee lady?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, good. I don't drink. I drink a lot of iced tea, and I don't think that's in the same category.
No.
Oh, now you're making me feel bad.
You don't know that. You don't need that here. It is the middle of August, and here it is about 18 degrees outside. In other words, I've got a woolly jumper on, and it's, iced tea just wouldn't
Well, it's about 95 degrees here, so iced tea seems to be a pretty good idea.
Good.
So listen, I told the listeners at the top of the show, I bragged about you, told a few lies probably, but what we want to, I know, but what we want to do today is talk about some of the drugs that are currently illegal. We're going to take a leap of faith here inside the opium den, and we're going to make the assumption that these drugs have been legalized, and we have a regulated market, and they are accessible with minor but important restrictions to the general public. And since you have a degree in psychology, what we'd like to talk about with you is how these drugs can be utilized, not so much in a recreational fashion, but as they can be used to assist people in certain stages of life to have a greater understanding of what their situation is, and perhaps utilize these drugs to make those transitions much smoother and less frightening and more beneficial.
Right.
So I'd like to start off by talking about the drug LSD. Now, LSD is my favorite substance. I've been consuming it now for just about 40 years, and I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Albert Hoffman in his home in Switzerland. And we had spent a very long afternoon talking about LSD, and we did touch on the subject of how it could be a substance for transitional moments in individuals' lives. So I kind of like to ask you if, again, assuming that we have this regulatory environment and the drugs are readily accessible without prescription and few conditions. Tell our listeners what you think in that context. Where do you believe, or how do you believe LSD could be of value?
Well, I think it can be of value to anybody who is stable enough and clear enough not to be completely freaked out by it, really at any stage in life. But I guess you're talking about kind of big transitions. One, of course, is a sort of growing up transition. I think, like so many of these very, very powerful and potentially dangerous drugs, you don't want to start too young. Very interestingly, Vaults of Erowid, did a survey asking experienced LSD users all sorts of questions, including what age do you think ideally you would want to start taking LSD. And people on the whole recommended, 18, 20. People have said even older. I think Thomas Metzinger, the German philosopher who has all sorts of ideas about drug futures, has recommended even older. But I think one of the values, if you do first have it sort of late teens, early 20s, is really a kind of a reassessment of, gosh, I'm not that kid anymore. Who am I? Who am I becoming? Where do I want to go? Because, of course, LSD, blows apart one's normal sense of self. And this is the kind of one of its great values, and, of course, why it can be so scary or even damaging, because it just blows things apart. And that gives you a fantastic opportunity for reassessment and moving on. Now, in my kind of fantasy world that you're talking about, where we've got through all the stumbling blocks, and we've got to some kind of legal situation where the drugs are available, I could imagine there being really quite a common, not perhaps common, but there would be expert users. Maybe they would be psychologists, but anyone who really has the expertise who would be able to help young people or their peers who've had these experiences before, and maybe even, you know, like kind of weekend retreats where you could go and really have a kind of growing up, almost ceremonially it could even become that way, as it does in many cultures where powerful drugs are used. You have a ceremony for these important life transitions.
Yeah, hallucinogens have been valued as a rite of passage throughout the centuries, and your idea of going to a retreat or a weekend type of scenario reflects on the set and setting aspect of consuming LSD. You want to be in a good mental state, and you want to be in a good physical environment where you're not going to be, you know, surprised or feel threatened by your surroundings. So, tell us how if you were to be one of these helpers, so to speak, and I think with your hallucinogenic experience, you would be well suited to help this transition for individuals. How would you go about doing that? What would be the routine? What would be the scenario for you if you were to do something like that?
Do you know, I couldn't just invent it out of the blue, and I hope if this happens in the future, there will have to be a lot of experimentation and working towards it. But, of course, you're right, set and setting is absolutely crucial. But I don't think there's any one right answer to that. One thing is you don't want to have people rushing in, as you said, no surprise. You've got to feel that not exactly this is an environment under your control, but this is an environment where you can feel completely safe, that you know what's going to happen. I think it depends very much on the people, but for me it would be outdoor situations in nature with plants and flowers and trees or mountains or water or whatever it is, which very much with LSD one feels close to. And also I think, rivers and the sea and these things, they throw up impermanence, you know, the notion of that we're all just kind of impermanent creatures, we're all part of nature, we're part of a flowing universe and everything is always changing, nothing ever stays. These sorts of lessons that come from the psychedelic drugs are easier to learn in an environment like that. I think then one needs ritualistic elements. Now, that's quite tricky because if you think of an LSD trip, which typically will be something like 8 hours, there are different phases in that trip. There's the kind of going in phase, there's the peak, which one may want to use. It doesn't last that long, maybe a couple of hours. One may want to use for the deepest insights and encouraging people to really look into what's arising, because that's the terrifying thing, when you have the courage to actually look straight in the face of whatever it is your mind is throwing up. And then that just needs somebody there helping, encouraging, because the helper doesn't know what's going to come up either. All they can do is help you see your own things. And then there's later phases where you can, in the kind of coming down stage or sort of smoothing off phase, can not push aside all the memories of what you've just been through, particularly if it was very difficult, and have guidance to help you then. And then looking forward, then, and making the transition back to relative normality, if one ever does go back to it after a period.
Easy there, Sue. Easy.
What?
So you go easy on what is considered normal and
yeah, right. But you at least end the trip, and then I think a helper's job, and certainly in this sort of context, would be to help smooth that transition, not in the sense of kind of making it easy, but in the sense of wanting to use what you have found and what you have explored to go forward. Now you have become a different person. And if you take a serious acid trip, as we're perhaps imagining here, relatively high dose and really facing up to what it brings up, you are changed by the end of that. And I think a helper's job is very much then to help you take those insights, not forget them, allow them to be harmful, take them forward to where you're going. And if this is some kind of rite of passage, of course, that's the whole point of it, that you are now a new person, a different person, facing life with what you've learned about yourself, about the world, about what you have to do or don't have to do.
Well, you touched upon a point that I'd like to further discuss. You talked about the dosing level of this type of experience. And when I had my opportunity to speak with Albert Hoffman, he felt that three times in life, high-dose LSD experiences would be valuable in the late teens, early 20s, your midlife, and then towards the end. So you're on the same kind of line there with what Albert was thinking. But let me ask you, what would you recommend to, and it may vary, but as far as getting some, you have someone that's going to experience this the situation with you, what would be your preparation with these individuals, and what type of dose level would you think would be most beneficial?
Well, are you specifically asking for at that age a sort of first trip?
No, I think we're on the same page in that regard. You know,
any of those early 20s.
Let's just say it's a young person whose worldview is still open to interpretation in a lot of ways because they're still young. What would your preparation? How would you go about, you know, selling the deal, so to speak? And what do you believe would be the proper dosage for the first time?
Selling a deal, I would not want to push it on anybody at all. But I learned.
Well, that's selling the deal might not have been the proper terminology.
I would even. It's a bit like sort of getting married or something like that. You know, always tell people not to do it. It's only if they really, really want to do it, they'll just go, yeah, well, I'm going to anyway.
Well, yeah, let's make the assumption I'm coming. You have a clinic or you have a situation.
Adventure playground.
You have a playground, this desirable candy type of deal, and I come to you and I say, Dr. Blackmore, I would like to expand my worldview. I'd like to see what this situation is all about. How would you prepare me for that, and what do you think would be the proper dose for someone their first experience?
Before I answer that question, let me say this. You've said I'm a psychologist. I am, but I am not a psychologist who has anything to do with people. Please, all you listeners out there, I am not, you know, a sort of psychotherapist or anything like that. I'm more like a neuroscientist. I mean, I'm obsessed with the nature of consciousness, what consciousness is, how on earth the brain can bring about, if that's the right word, subjective experiences. So I have no training, no expertise whatsoever in any kind of therapy or in dealing with human beings. So just to get that straight,
okay.
You're talking to me as a consciousness researcher and a drug user. In that context, I would say this. Preparation, I wouldn't want over-preparation because I don't think it helps to go into something so extraordinary. If you've never had at it before, it's such an extraordinary thing. You need certain warnings. And you need certain instructions. You need to know that it may blow apart everything you ever thought, that it may turn your mind inside out, that you will not be able to get out of it. There is no antidote, that it goes on for a long time and it will be tiring.
Well, actually, let me jump in there. I hate to interrupt you, but as far as there is no antidote, I wouldn't want that to actually be the understood. There are antidotes for someone who is in the midst of a hallucinogenic experience that needs to get out. Just a couple of Xanax or a couple of Valium will do wonders for bringing someone out of that negative, if they're having a negative experience. Now, you may contradict me if you believe, but I wanted to make sure that at least I gave my opinion on how you can get out of a situation like that.
Okay, yes. It will help a lot. I agree with you. It will help. It'll calm people down. It doesn't get you. It doesn't. You know. You can't just stop it and as though it. You know. The end of it. That it won't. It won't do that. Yes, it could calm people down if they're in a very bad place and help them get out of that. I agree. But if it's going reasonably well, but it's pretty scary. You know. It's. You can't just stop. It's like, you know, being on a journey somewhere. Hence being called a trip. Although I guess we might disagree on how useful those kinds of drugs might be in helping. Anyway, those are the sort of things I would want to tell people. I would want them to prepare physically in the sense of getting enough sleep beforehand, eating adequately beforehand, being, you know, reasonably fit and prepared for it. But beyond that, I don't think I would want people to have, you know, kind of a great preparation. Although possibly, I mean, it sort of depends on the person, doesn't it? I meditate every day. I've been training in Zen for 30 years now. And for anyone who has any kind of training of that kind, then I would expect them to, you know, that would be helpful. But I wouldn't have huge preparation. As for dose, well, it's going to be dependent on body weight. But if you took an average body weight person, I would say for the kind of purpose we're talking about, a serious, serious trip, they would want to have 125 micrograms, something of that kind. You don't want less than about 100. I think it wouldn't be intense enough, and you wouldn't want something so much that most people couldn't handle it at all and wouldn't be able to benefit from it. What do you think?
I agree with you on the preparation aspect. I mean, they're about to experience something that is literally indescribable, so you don't want to set up any type of false expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
You want them to understand that what is going to happen is going to be at points it can be very enlightening, and at other points it can be very frightening, but it is going to be completely different than anything they've ever experienced before. And since it's something that they've never experienced before and something that you really can't relate to, I wouldn't be too specific about what their expectations should be. I would want them to feel comfortable. I'd want them to understand that this is a temporary situation, that this is an exploration, and they may go into some dark corners and they may go into some very bright corners. I would try to keep it on that level, not to be very specific. But with regards to dosing, I think, well, most of the folks who experienced LSD in the late 50s and then into the 60s, when it became more of a mainstream recreational substance, most all of the LSD consumed during those days were in the much higher dose range, the 250 to 300 microgram level, which would, for most people, except for maybe Andre the Giant, for most people, 300 micrograms will be a full-blown hallucinogenic experience. And I would think that if I were handling these type of playground adventures, I would go to gravitate.
You'd go higher than I would.
Mm. Yeah, 250, 300 micrograms to give them the absolute, not the absolute maximum, but to maximize their experience, especially as it's their first time.
Isn't this interesting? I mean, just imagine that this comes about, and these are the kinds of discussions that people like you and me and lots of other people are having, and being able to experiment. We'd have to be very, very careful, and there would have to be various safeguards, but we would, you know, we'd need to look at the evidence before things were legal from all the people doing it illegally, but then we'd need to try and see what happens and how well it works. Because, of course, most people now who are reporting what they've had, for example, the Vaults of Erowid is wonderful. You can go and read all these, and there are other sites as well. You can read all these accounts, and people will say what dose they've had. But it's only what dose they think they've had. I mean, most, because they're having to buy illegal drugs very often from labs that they just don't know how the drugs are produced and so on, we don't know what those doses are. Whereas back in the time when it was coming from Sandoz and, you know, pure Sandoz, which I'm lucky enough to have had a couple of times, then they did know what the dose was.
Well, yeah.
And we would, again, in this fantasy, wonderful world, which I hope will come about, we will know. And then we will actually be able to find out what happens and make sensible decisions about that.
So let's use the scenario that I'm coming to you and you have these facilities and this ability for the psychedelic playground for us all. Would you do it on a one-on-one scenario, or would you do it in a small group of two or three?
You're asking me these questions as though I'm going to be the one who's in charge of this place. You know, I think I'm going to be the one going along and saying, hey, I'm nearly 60. I think, you know, I need to kind of make a transition here in my life. I've been working too hard and wearing myself out. I want to explore my own mind. Can I come along, please, to you as an expert who's done loads more trips than me and who's, is a therapist or is trained in some way to help. And please, can I come to your place and you tell me the answer to these questions?
Well, you don't think that your life experiences and your expertise with hallucinogens, you don't think that that would make you, whether or not you wanted to be or not, I can understand that, but don't you think that would make you an ideal candidate for this? For this visionary?
Well, I hope it would. I hope it would, but I don't have the answers really now. And I would hate your listeners to be thinking that you know I'm saying something and they should believe it. We're so far off from that.
Let me change about it.
I would say that that people who've never had it before, first time. I think it would be better for them to be just with a one-on-one, or at least to be not taking it along with one on many, maybe, but not taking it along with other beginners, because it can be very distracting, particularly if they're people you know and they're getting upset and you get upset because they're getting upset and so on. I remember once it was actually a mushroom trip with a friend of mine, a very, very experienced drug user. And we had accidentally much higher dose than we'd intended with these mushrooms, because we'd made this omelette, and we decided to have a quarter of the omelette each, and we went out walking, and it didn't really seem to be having very much effect, so we came back and ate the other half, and then once. Yeah, we were trying to be sensible. And he went off to the loo, and I was lying on this bed, and I was having really, really awful hallucinations of torture and murder, and very, very unpleasant. And I was doing okay. I was thinking, my God, the things my brain throws up. Oh dear, what does this say about me? Well, never mind. You know, just look into it, allow it to do its thing. You know, all this kind of stuff. I was managing okay until I started to hear him screaming, his banging on the walls and shouting that he wanted to die. And I went over, you know, in there and sort of saw him, and he was shouting and banging and crashing about the place. And, you know, that is very disturbing. I think because he was a good friend, it made it quite difficult, because I really, you know, I was conflicted about how to deal with this. It was fine in the end. I said, okay, well, if you want to kill yourself, then, you know, can I help? How would you like to go about it? And that, you know, stopped him, and he calmed down. But, you know, and it's perhaps not a very good example. It just came to mind when you were talking about because what you don't want for somebody's first trip, or for a particularly a trip for a particular purpose that they might be doing, if we had these kind of rites of passage places that you could go, would be you having real trouble having to cope with a friend of yours who's having trouble. You know, it should right. be an experience for yourself. It should be self-indulgent in the best possible way.
I agree. It should absolutely self-indulgent in the best possible way. And I think it should be, at least for the first experience, it should be a one-on-one situation where there are no additional distractions. Right. Should the trip take an unpleasant, have an unpleasant phase, or conversely, if it is in a wildly ecstatic phase, the individual is going to want to have someone that they can relate, you know, the ecstasy or the agony to, and be able to have that particular person focus on them. My next question would be
before you go on to the next question. Yeah. Something else came up earlier. You were talking about set and setting. And the thought came to mind about a completely different drug, ketamine, and how important set and setting is with so many drugs. As a close friend of mine died recently, his name is Richard Gregory. Some of your listeners may have heard of him. Very famous British psychologist who wrote a book called Iron Brain, all about visual illusions, back in the 60s. Almost all psychology students had to read this book. And he wrote books called Strange Perceptions and The Nature of Mind. You know, he's a wonderful psychologist, a very quirky guy, always told lots of puns, and a very, very wonderful kind of mind. And he took ketamine once, and he took it in the lab in Bristol where we worked. And he had a couple of colleagues there who wanted to test things like his visual capacity and goodness knows what else. And he had the most vile, awful time. He wrote it up in this book called Strange Perceptions. He had a really awful time and said, this is a terrible, terrible drug, and I would never take it again. And, you know, and it was under, you know, it was very safe conditions, very clean, you know, all of that, but just horrible lab. And when they were doing these tests on his vision and everything, he just hated it. Whereas my experience of ketamine with a similar dose, also in a safe environment, but a very lovely, lovely environment with a friend near me, was just wonderful and fascinating. And the kind of experiment that I wanted to do with ketamine were that I had heard that it can be similar to out-of-body experiences. And, of course, I've done lots and lots of research on out-of-body experiences and had them myself and was really interested from that point of view. But my idea of an experiment was to lie in a waterbed with quadraphonic speakers around with gentle music and with a good friend there in a nice, quiet and attractive space and see whether it was like an out-of-body experience or not. That's the, you know, the set and setting, that's a good example of both extremes, I think.
Yes, and regarding that, it was Huxley. Huxley was a good friend of Albert Hoffman's. And Albert began his reasoning and thinking about LSD. He took a more of a clinical, do it in the lab type of approach, and you know, run this test and do this and see how it works from in a clinical environment. And it was Huxley who convinced Hoffman that the clinical environment was not the place to experience to experience hallucinogens. You needed to be out in nature. You needed to commune with other living things as opposed to the sterile clinical aspect of it. And actually, Albert came to believe more into the Huxley ideal than his own. I mean, Hoffman was a scientist, Huxley was a writer, so they had two different mental arrangements on the issue, but
Hoffman had those deep mystical experiences as a child in the mountains.
Yes, he did. Yes.
So I think Huxley was able to, as it were, link the thought to that,
exactly.
Which then was very important to Hoffman, as I understand it.
Exactly. There's where I was going with.
Unlike you, I've never had an afternoon. I have met him once, and I was so awestruck, and I just thought it was one. I just speaking to him a few words and seeing his wonderful bright eyes and smile. He was 100. It was at his 100th birthday celebrations that I met him.
Were you in Basel?
Extraordinary. Yeah.
I was there too.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize that. Yes, it was wonderful.
It was very wonderful, yeah. And Albert is he was a very nice, sweet man. Mm-hmm. And you're right about the twinkle in his eye. Were you there for the final ceremony when everybody sang happy birthday and the like?
Yes.
Man, there was a dry eye in the house.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful experience. And I'd met him 3 years earlier, and he invited me to his party. But I found him to be a very brilliant man, but he had a very nice common touch. He was very sweet. He was mischievous. He liked to joke around. And maybe because it was towards the end of his life at 97, he was more reflective about how things happened during the years where he was taking a lot of heat for LSD. But he was just a very sweet, sweet man.
Mm-hmm. And we will never know how much his sweetness, his twinkly eye, or his longevity had anything to do with the drugs he took.
I mean,
so many people ask him, and of course he can't answer, and nor can any of us.
That's a good question. I wanted to get into that, but we'll jump into that now. The nature of Albert, your nature, my nature, anyone's nature, is LSD really going to have that much of a transformative effect on your basic personality, or is it going to be an enhancement? I think Albert all his life was just a nice man, a very brilliant guy, nice guy, kind of a jokester. And the LSD really didn't change that per se, but maybe it amplified it. So do you think that we're pretty much who we are as a young person, and as we go through life, we're going to stay pretty much that way, and LSD could be an enhancement to our personality? Or do you think that taking LSD could be transformed from someone who was a bad person to someone who was a good person? Do you think there's potential for that?
I think both. I mean, to some extent, of course, our personalities are molded by our genes. To a large extent, they're molded by our childhood experiences and so on, and yet we go on being able to change. So for the most part, I would say that it allows a deepening of reflection about your own, about yourself, perhaps enabling you to make the most of certain aspects of your personality. In other words, to enhance it, as you said. But there are enough stories of dramatic transformation that I think it is possible. I mean, imagine somebody who has a, you know, has had a really tough time in their life, and they've ended up being really bad. You know, they're in prison, or they've done, you know, they've done terrible things, and they confront themselves hard in an LSD trip. There are plenty of stories around of this kind, and really go through something deep and say, actually, I don't want to do that anymore, and that can happen. That can happen also with other psychedelics. It's not just LSD, and people, as you know, are experimenting with other drugs for trying to get people out of addiction. But certainly there can be grand transformations. But I don't think one can expect them or create them to order. I mean, you're not going to just take any old person who's really behaving very badly or just transform them like that. But what you can do is provide the opportunity for people to step back or be blown apart, if you like, and see themselves in a completely different way, see their behaviors, their past, see how things came about. I mean, one of the things that does happen with many psychedelic drugs, and it also happens in near-death experiences, which I've done a lot of research on as well, is that people are able to experience memories from the past, either things that other people did to them, both nice and nasty things, and things that they did to other people, both nice and nasty things, whether it is, you know, throwing a rock at your enemy at school when you were five, or, you know, serious adult good and bad things, to look at those things with flooded with the emotion of, it's all right, actually, it's all just the universe doing what it's doing. This is how it is. So instead of blaming yourself or others, or praising yourself or others, you just see these things. Oh, that's how it is. And one can have, in an LSD trip or in a near-death experience or in a spontaneous mystical experience, this extraordinary sense of, well, I am the universe. This is all part of me and part of everybody else, and it's all right. Now, from that place, it is possible then to come back to ordinary life from wherever you've been, and retain something of that acceptance. It's a kind of acceptance of oneself and one's actions and other people's actions, and a lessening of blame and a lessening of pride. And that really can be quite transformative for many people.
Oh, I agree. The fellow who developed Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill, I guess is only his first name, as most people are familiar with him, he credited taking LSD with causing him to quit drinking. He thought it was one of the most important parts of his experience as an alcoholic, and he credited LSD till the day he died. Now, you speak about near-death experiences. Let's move into that area a little bit, if you don't mind, and look at it from the standpoint of folks who are near death, not having a near-death experience, but folks who are near death, terminal patients, have anxieties of, you know, just a bushel of anxieties regarding that. How do you think that LSD could help assuage some of those fears?
Oh, I think it can be absolutely wonderful. Of course, again, it has to be done carefully. And this is another hope that I have for a post-prohibition world, that there would be hospices, or some kind of similar place where terminally ill people are cared for properly, and that LSD or perhaps other psychedelics could be used to help them look forward to death, face death. I think what I was saying there about acceptance is probably the key to it all, because if you are really facing death quite soon, there are all sorts of fears. I suppose that the fear of pain and the actual process of death is the obvious one, but the ones that are helped more, I think, by psychedelics are things like guilt, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have said this to this person, oh, I wish I hadn't hurt this person, those kinds of guilt things. Pointlessness, what's it all been for? If I'm just going to die now, what's the point of it all, pointlessness of the universe? Feelings of failure, I didn't manage to do the things I said I was going to do, I've let people down, I've failed. And I think psychedelic therapy can transform all those feelings radically into acceptance and into peace, to be at peace with what you have done, what you haven't done, the fact that this was your life, this was other people's lives, you did the best you could, you tried, these were the circumstances, actually it's all right. And then to go forwards thinking, this is actually my life, I accept this, I accept
that's the word that I think is the best word to use, acceptance. It's a matter of accepting what has happened, what didn't happen, what you did, what you didn't do. It's a matter of acceptance. And once you learn to accept everything that has gone on around you, there is a certain calm and there is a certain wisdom that comes from that. And that's probably one of the best benefits that I've had over the years of doing LSD, is that I've just accepted everything as it is. It doesn't make you, uncaring or who cares what happens or anything like that. It's just an acceptance of what does happen. And we talk.
That's a funny thing, isn't it? Because people, when you talk, like, I'm glad you mentioned that, because people often think, well, then you wouldn't bother to do anything, would you? Because logically, that seems how it would be, but it isn't like that. You're quite right. When you feel that way, you don't stop doing things. You don't. It's the same with the whole free will thing. Now, there's another aspect to it that we typically, most people, spend most of their life believing in free will, believing that somehow they are, I don't know, their minds or their consciousness or something is in charge and can make the decisions and so on. And I think psychedelic experiences, near-death experiences, put a big dent in that and lead one to see that we're not this little kind of nugget of consciousness that has control over life. Actually, life does its things to us and we are part of life. So one aspect of that acceptance is rethinking the whole notion of free will. Now, this is something that I've often taught students when I used to teach a course on consciousness for many years in Bristol, and I would talk about the evidence on free will and, you know, how the brain is always planning these actions and, you know, how all the decisions are made in different bits of the brain and so on. And students very often say, well, if I really believed there was no free, I wouldn't bother to get up in the morning. Why should I ever do anything? And my answer is, okay, fine, tomorrow morning, lie in bed and set, like, this is it, there's no point in anything, I don't have any free will, and, you know, it's all absolutely meaningless, and just lie there and see what happens. And what happens, of course, is you lie there and there's no point in it, and then you kind of think, oh, I've got to go to the loo, so you get up and go to the loo, and you think, shall I go back to bed, or, you know, oh, well, actually, I'm hungry, I think I'll go and get some breakfast, and, you know, life goes on. And then you find that actually that body will get on with stuff and quite fine without you sitting in there thinking, I'm terribly important, I've got to decide what to do, it's up to me, it's my responsibility, and all that kind of heavy,
yeah, you need stuff. To learn to embrace the randomness of life and give, I mean, I think LSD, at least for me, it allowed me to give up control. You know, it's like,
yes, that's exactly, that says it better than I was saying. That's exactly what I'm getting at. People are terrified of giving up control. But actually, when you do give it up, and this is something I've practiced through, because I think free will is an illusion, so practiced it through that as well as through meditation and taking drugs. When you do give up control, actually, it's amazing. I think
it is truly kind of amazing. It's truly amazing. I mean, you experience life in a much fuller, much greater contextual aspect when you give up control, because trying to maintain control excludes so much of your environment that you're so focused on maintaining the control of a small part of it.
Yeah.
If you give up control, you're flooded with experiences and life views, and it's a much, much better situation to give up control than to try to maintain control.
And I think that brings us to perhaps the deepest aspect of facing death. that again LSD can help with, because it can blow apart your sense of self. And instead of feeling, well, there's the universe and there's me here observing it, you either become some part, like you might become that tree over there or whatever, or you can have a classic mystical experience of oneness and dissolution of self, in which you simply become the universe. And when you've had that experience of oneness, particularly if it's fairly stable, rather than a sort of flash, which I think quite a lot of people get very briefly in various ways. Mm-hmm. But if you can have it stably enough for a while to kind of get used to it a bit, that really I am just all of this. Well, all of this is going to go on. And so death is, you know, there wasn't actually a me to die. Who's going to die? I am just an ephemeral thing that keeps, you know, the illusion of self just pops up again and again and again, when really I'm just part of the universe. And that transition can lead one to go, okay, it's not really dying. It's only the same thing that happens from moment to moment. There isn't really a me who lived my life and observed everything happening. You know, there were lots of illusory me thrown up again and again and again and again. As long as there's bodies here, they'll keep being thrown up. But deep down, there's just one universe, one lot of stuff. And that will go on forever.
And it's like in a phrase in one of George Harrison's songs, he said, "Life goes on within you and without you."
Yes.
And
yes,
I thought that was pretty classic. He was the smart Beatle.
Absolutely. I was a Beatles fan. Oh, when I was 14, 15, I was a Beatle maniac. Yep.
Oh, did you ever see them live? Did you get the opportunity to see them live?
Oh, absolutely. And George Harrison lived just down the road from us. And after school, this is when I was younger, when I was 13, I used to go on my bicycle and hang out outside his house. And one time the milkman came and they opened the gate and went in, and we ran in, two of us ran in after the milkman and got to the front door. And Patty Boyd was there and George, and they shouted, "Go away, you school kids. If you don't, I'll come and smack you." And we went, and ran away.
"Please hit me, George. Hit me.
I did get his autograph though once.
Well, good
but
for
it
you.
Was Paul that I went to the Hammersmith Odeon on my 13th birthday and saw them live, and I stood on the back of my chair and screamed, "Paul, Paul, Paul," until I fell off my chair.
What do you think about Paul now?
Oh, I like some of his songs. I wouldn't scream anymore.
Well, yeah, musically, I think, you know, all musicians have their absolute brilliant period, and then they have their living on their laurels period, and then they might have a flash of brilliance here and there. And I think that for Paul McCartney, I think the brilliance of their music was a collaborative event or effect or effort. And his single work, you know, with Wings and the like, you know, it was good stuff, but I think the brilliance was with the Fab Four. But my question about what do you think about him now is not so much a musical question, but as just, you know, what he says in life. Do you think that, here's a question, do you think when Linda died, he went off the rails to a degree? I mean, he seemed to be in a very loving, committed,
great
relationship.
You know, I don't follow these things. I don't honestly have a clue.
Ah.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's quite
all right.
I
can't really answer.
Well, we'll just move right past that.
we'll have to. Sorry.
Well, let me ask you this, if you don't mind speaking to this. Tell me and our listeners what your first LSD experience was like, your age and all that kind of stuff.
I don't remember which was my first experience.
I don't.
But you know, it's a long time ago.
I'm older than you, and I remember my first.
Oh, do you? Probably if I went back and read my diary, it would tell me, and I'd go, "Oh, of course, it was that one." But oddly enough, I don't remember. But I would have been either 19 or 20 when I was a student at Oxford, and I after the first time I'd had it, I think I probably had it a couple of times a year for a few years. And I mean, I can tell you about I can remember all kinds of things from some of those experiences, just not the first one.
Well, that's okay. I mean, let's talk about the experiences, whether it was your first or not, but that were,
well,
were
I remember
very meaningful
one.
And impacted your life dramatically.
I remember one with my then boyfriend, and we went walking in the university parks in Oxford and along the River Charwell, where there were punts going past, and it was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day. And we came to this patch. There was a beautiful oak tree, a big, very ancient oak tree that the path went by. But there'd obviously been cows or something, because the ground was all muddy. It'd been trampled by cows, so it was very, very lumpy. But it had dried out, so it was quite awkward to walk on. And the patterns in the mud and the patterns of the bark on this beautiful oak tree were absolutely stunning, you know, amazing. And we sat there. I have no idea how long, but I would have thought perhaps half an hour or, you know, a long, long time, exploring the beautiful colors and the patterns. And I had this, you know, extraordinary, intense experience of the beauty of these things. And also the feeling that I had never known any place quite as intimately as I knew this place. And it was a quiet path, and I don't think anybody went past. And then we saw somebody coming. And it was an old, old man, stooped with a stick. And as I said, it was a bright sunny day, and he was sort of squinting against the bright sunlight and coming along very slowly with his stick. And of course, it seemed even slower. It seemed as though he was hardly moving at all. And I was a bit frightened because I, you know, realized that I was in a pretty weird state, and I just sort of hoped I would be able to just smile and he would go past. And instead, he hesitated. There was kind of shadow across the path under this great tree. It was shady, and it was bright sunny everywhere else. And he came to the edge of the shadow. It was kind of my space, if you like. And he said to me, "Excuse me, young lady." And I thought, "Oh, dear, help, will you?" He said, "My eyes are bad, and I cannot see my way across. Would you give me your arm?" And so this place, which I knew so intimately, I had to guide an old man with a stick, and I went and I took his arm very gently, and it seemed like 100 years crossing this patch, and I very slowly and carefully walked with him across this great lumpy, muddy, ankle-twisting-y kind of patch to the other side. And when we got there, he turned to me and said, "Thank you very much. Good day to you," and went on his way. And John and I sat there, and I was completely, you know, I thought, is this a hallucination? I can't believe that, you know, here I am, and I know this place so intimately. No one, as far as I know, my whole life ever has asked me to guide them across a place, you know, a patch of mud. And nor have I ever in my life known a patch of mud as intimately as I do this one. Surely he must be a hallucination. And it was quite funny because, you know, then we carried on and other things happened. But a few days later, John rang me up and he said, "It wasn't a hallucination. I saw him again. I saw him again. He was walking the box. He's real."
Well, I want to, do you know, do you remember how much what your dose was for that trip?
We'd have had a single tab each. I mean, though in those days they were blotters, but I don't remember it exactly.
It was probably 250, 300, because the first LSD that came out was intentionally 250 micrograms, because that was the dose that Albert did intentionally the first time. So a lot of the original LSD, and I've been told this by Nick Sand and some of the other chemists, that the 250 micrograms was an intentional dose based upon Albert's first intentional use. Mm-hmm. Now, I do have a question for you. Again, you don't have to answer this one, or you can speculate it outside of your own experience. But back in, you know, when Timothy Leary was doing his thing, and I'm not a big fan of Timothy Leary overall, and neither was Albert. But, you know, Leary had his moments, but we don't want to, you know, get so much into that. But one thing, you know, Leary always said was that LSD made sex so much better. Now, I've been doing LSD for 40 years. I've never had sex under the influence of LSD, mainly because it's like I always took very high doses, and I didn't know who I'd be, who I was having sex with, who I was talking to. So I never really got that. Is that a bunch of hype or just something that I missed out on? What is your experience, either personally or philosophically on that, or anecdotally?
Oh, my experience, I can remember one time with a man that I very much fancied and had was a boyfriend of mine and had made love to, I don't know, remember how many times before or how long into our relationship we were, but I do remember feeling quite turned on in an extraordinarily wonderful way and thinking, wow, gosh, sex will be amazing. And then we started sort of stroking each other's arms. And our arms, I can just remember, his arm was so fascinating. And every hair on his arm was so interesting. We never got beyond the
That's exactly it. That is exactly every experience I had when I was in any type of an intimate situation with another. You just got distracted and then
forget
about it. Well, that's good. Yeah. I'm glad I'm not the only one out there.
No, you're not the only one.
Because I felt like maybe I missed out on something, but I didn't really think so. But it seemed to be such a big deal. But since we touched on...
You were asking quite a lot about dose. And here's an interesting something that I did recently, which was with a friend who had been anorexic for 10 years. Now, anorexia is a really terrible thing, and she had become, over those 10 years, race-like, you know, skin and bones, mm-hmm. and really quite disturbed. And I know her very well, and I felt that, and she had had acid before. I would not have encouraged this request of hers if she hadn't had it before, because I would have thought it was too dangerous. And of course, in a way, you might say, what a stupid thing to do, to let someone who's, you know, terribly low body weight and in such a terrible mental position to have an acid trip. But she felt it might help, and I agreed. And so we went, one of my favorite things to do, walking on the cliffs of South Devon. I live in Devon in the south of England, where the sea is, you know, it's the Atlantic crashing cold right. on great cliffs. And
I'm familiar with the area, yeah.
Right. Well, you know, you can imagine on these beautiful cliffs. Very rarely with sunny days, but never mind. It was a reasonably nice day then. And I suggested that she had, I think it was about 75 micrograms. Her body weight was very, very low. Mm-hmm. I estimated that if it was me, I would have maybe 125, something like that. And so I was kind of adjusting it for the equivalent body weight. I'm a sort of normal weight, and she was two-thirds my weight. So that was kind of the sum that I did. I took about half a dose because I wanted to be close enough with her to feel some kind of an effect so that might make me more able to be helpful if necessary. But I didn't want to take a lot because we're walking on cliffs and you know, anything might happen and I might be needed. And that worked extraordinarily well. Now, it wasn't, you know, you're talking about what I consider very, very high doses, but this was enough for a truly extraordinary experience. We sat on the, we walked along these cliffs for a couple of hours, probably an hour and a half anyway, and came to a lovely beach. And we sat there with the waves lapping and the seagulls shrieking. And there was another friend with us as well, who had a similar dose to her. But everyone was kind of doing their own thing, really. She sat there for ages. I and this other guy went off paddling, not far away, but, you know, we were paddling on, climbing on the rocks a bit and just enjoying the place. And she sat there for a long time, and then she went paddling. And at some point, I got out the picnic that we'd brought, and I handed her a few grapes, and she ate them. And I didn't inquire too much what was going on. She knew I was there if she needed any help. But it had the most extraordinary effect on her. She said afterwards, oddly and laughably, you might say, that it was absolutely extraordinary for her that she was able, when I offered her a grape, to take it and eat it. Now, to any listening anorexic or someone who is
no
anorexic,
that's a big step. That's a big step.
That is an enormously extraordinary thing to just be natural about it. Mm-hmm. And she was able to do that. But this was in the context of a very, very deep exploration into herself and who she'd become and what the anorexia was, what it had done to her, how much it was her and how much it was it. a whole lot. I mean, I don't think she can really describe a lot of what she went through, although some of it she described. But the upshot was one of these transformations that we were talking about earlier on. She, fairly soon after that, she gave up her anorexia. Now, I would not say that the LSD was the event that did that. There were several things that happened. I mean, she'd come to the end of the road. She was that thin. It was that dangerous. You know, it was either die or do something. But this was part of the do something. This was part of her attempt to work out, actually, where she was going and what it was all about and who she was and the point of it. And, oh, you know, just thinking about it, you probably hear my voice. I'm embarrassed a bit. My voice gone a bit funny just thinking about that, because this dear person is now well and eating again. And this was a deep inner exploration on not a terribly, terribly high dose at all. So, you know, dose is a dodgy question. But,
yeah,
you know,
you're absolutely right. Example. You're absolutely right. I mean, I have over the years taken LSD with folks who, you know, if it was a piece of blotter that you were fairly sure was 250 or 300 micrograms, someone might just take a half or a third of that and have a very wonderful experience. So maybe dose. Maybe my thinking on dose should be adjusted to a degree. But I
think there is a kind of threshold, you know, below which you're not really tripping,
right,
and above which you are. It's not as black and white as that, but to some extent, you have to get over that threshold. It's something about control. It's something about blasting through the control so that you are no longer able to be in control, and that's the transition point that you need to go through.
Right, and perhaps a high dose allows that transition from in control to out of control to be easier. If you're in a smaller dose, there may be more of a battle of, I'm going to stay in control, I want to lose control.
Exactly.
And you need that decision made for you by the drug
itself. But I must say, I've never taken a really high dose. Perhaps I should one day. And perhaps when it's legal, I will.
Your Honor.
We'll see. Yes.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Well, let me ask you a general question, and I'll preface it with how the situation is here for me. We're both about the same age. I just turned 60, and I think you're approaching that.
Yeah, I'm 59.
As a 60-year-old adult, I'm not all that, you know, tied into the young people, although I do speak on college campuses and the like, but I have found that two things. LSD is harder to come by at my stage of life. And secondly, the dose level is considerably less than it was in its heyday or its glory days. Do you think that similar situation exists in Great Britain? Is it easy to get?
Or is it? It's not at your age either. I mean, I think it just is very difficult to get, because I do know some young people and they say it's very hard to get. People don't want it. They want fun. They like MDMA. They like the empathy. They like the dancing. They like the fun. They like the speed. They like cocaine. Life is very much more stressful, fast moving. People want drugs to cope with that. I think there are relatively fewer people who are prepared to invest a long time. I mean, if you're going to take it seriously, you need to invest 24 hours minimum,
right,
in doing it, and you need to prepare yourself to some extent if you're going to make the most of it. People, that's just not what street drugs are about these days.
Well, that's a very good point. We have this instant gratification, instant satisfaction mindset, and the drugs that you mentioned, MDMA, cocaine, amphetamines, you know, it's a quick up, quick down, and you can have a lot of fun, and it doesn't require as much preparation or as much anxiety, perhaps, as taking LSD.
Or courage.
Courage.
The opposite of requiring courage. I think LSD requires courage. Back in the 70s, when I first took it, that was the end of the hippie era, but there was still this kind of, let's explore the mind. You know, all these old people and our parents and things are only interested in jobs and money. But what we want to explore the mind and understand ourselves and reach out to the universe, all of that sort of stuff, you know. Of course there are people around still like that. But the people who are taking drugs are not doing it for that reason.
That's a good point. I still think there's probably, well, do you think there are, you know, there are as many people today interested in hallucinogens as there were, I mean, on a, you know, on an adjusted prorated basis? Do you think the the body of those who are interested in hallucinogens has stayed pretty much the same as far as, you know, the amount of people, you know, prorated for population adjustments? Or do you think hallucinogens have become less popular?
I would say much less popular. I mean, there are people like you and me of our sort of age who have maintained their interest since early on. There are some young people and people of all ages, but the majority, I mean, when I was teaching, I've left the university now, but when I was teaching in the university and talked to the students about this, and I think because of the way I was talking about things, they could trust me and we could have open discussions about these things. Very, very few of them had ever taken LSD, and their attitude seemed mostly to be, ooh, well, that's a dangerous drug, isn't it? You know? And they didn't know people who'd taken it, and they didn't have any reason to want to, most of them. And there were quite few. There were some who were into meditation and other kinds of mental training or spiritual disciplines or whatever who were interested in it, but it not being easy to get. Some of them got it, but most of them didn't.
Well, let me ask you this then. If we do get into that fantasy playground area where these drugs are available, do you think that it would, how long do you think it would take to reverse the power of propaganda against LSD? Do you think, I don't think it would automatically be like really popular if all of a sudden you can get it. I don't think anybody is waiting to do drugs or waiting for the drug laws to change before they go out and do drugs. I don't know anybody that says, man, I'd love to do cocaine and as soon as it's legal, I'm going to. I think people who want to do drugs are doing them now. But what's your sense of, if you can share with us, what is your sense of what would happen if the drug was legally available? Do you think there'd be a renaissance? Do you think it would stay, underground, but it would stay in a very small, segmented part of the population? What do you think would happen?
Well, in a way, I hope that it would stay quite small, because I think LSD, above all, I mean, interesting, we've spent our whole time talking about LSD, but that's probably because it is the kind of the epitome of a psychedelic drug. You know, it's not to be played with. You can play with it if you know what you're doing, but it's not to be treated just as a kind of recreational fun at all. So I would be very worried if suddenly everybody started taking it, but I don't think they would. It's got that legacy of fear, you know, going back to the CIA and all the awful history of it, and it being Class A restricted here. Class A classified here. In this country, I think it probably would be a slow take-up, because, you know, people would try it, and there would be idiots who would try it in the wrong circumstances and have a very bad time, and I think people would be cautious. But we won't know. And this is one of the reasons it's so difficult, because we won't know till we try it. There's no real precedent for legalizing the most serious drugs. You know, there's plenty of countries that have legalized cannabis and so on, but we don't have a real precedent to find out. So I'm only guessing. My guess would be that it wouldn't be a sudden, you know, instant uptake. I think there'd be a huge uptake of cannabis, of MDMA, of the easier drugs, mm-hmm. but I don't think of LSD, and probably not of DMT. I mean, DMT is the most, you haven't asked me what was your most horrific drug experience, but DMT, I mean, I'm really glad I had it. It was amazing, but, you know, real tough one, really, you know, quite hard, quite extraordinary. I think those sorts of drugs would be, you know, people tell each other, don't they, and would get around. This is not a drug to have fun, this is a drug, you know, do you want to be serious? And the serious people probably would.
Well, the whole explosion, though, of LSD was that it was a fun drug. I mean, that's how it was sold. That's how it was used, and unfortunately, it ended up being abused in that context. But
we're not going to have the tune on, turn in, drop out sort of thing again, are we?
I think we'd have to mitigate that and modify it to a degree. But I do believe that, especially young people. I mean, that. I don't know if you're going to get many 50, 60-year-old, middle-aged people that are going to go, okay, man, I missed out on the acid experience. I think I'm going to try a little LSD to find out what it's like. But I think that there would be a resurgence, because it's hard to say what the underground movement is like now on a numbers basis. But I think that I think you would see, and again, this contradicts your thought, and you probably know more about it than I do, but I speak to students as well, but I think there would be a renaissance in hallucinogens among the young people. The social networking, the lack of privacy, all these things that have been brought about by the internet has tried to make everybody connected. Now, there's a lot of argument that it's disconnected everyone by giving the facade of connection. But I think the social networking mindset of young people, I think there would be an interest and perhaps a renaissance in young people doing that drug. And I wouldn't like you. So you hope not. And I tend to think that.
I'd like a renaissance, but I'd like it to not be just masses and masses of people just throwing themselves into it without any thought.
Oh, I agree. We're right on that point. But I would like to see. I mean, as far cocaine and amphetamines, and I don't have a lot of problem with those drugs per se. But I would like to see more people taking LSD if they were able to take it in the right setting and get the benefits. I don't think anybody would come away from an LSD experience if it was more positive than negative. I can't believe anybody coming away from that would not feel that their life has been enhanced or been improved. So I'm not for putting it in the drinking supply, but I wouldn't be a turn on, tune in, drop out individual, but I would be a pretty strong advocate for experimenting with LSD. I could be wrong, but I'd go out and I would preach the gospel, so to speak. But I'll tell you, just a little off topic, I'll tell you an interesting story. As when Albert Hoffman was in his final years, they tried to get in contact with Steve Jobs because Steve Jobs said taking LSD was one of the three most important things in his entire life. So, they were always trying to get people who have had positive experiences to tell their story because all you see in the paper are all the negative stories. So Rick Doblin contacted Steve Jobs through an intermediary and said that Albert Hoffman would like to write him a letter, ask him, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So they said, okay. So Albert wrote Steve Jobs a letter and was talking. I don't know the letter. I don't know the wording. I'm getting this secondhand, but I think it's pretty accurate. And so Steve Jobs then gets sure, I'd love to meet with Albert Hoffman. So Rick Doblin was acting as the intermediary, and when he called Steve Jobs to get a little more in depth about it, Steve Jobs says, "Listen, this I'll tell you what my opinion is." He says, "I think we should just put it in the water supply." So that was the end of the contact with Steve Jobs, Rick Doblin, and Albert Hoffman. But it's interesting that that, I mean, it's kind of an offhand statement. But yeah. I think what that underscores, or what he really meant, was that this should be something for the masses to investigate and use as a positive tool, as opposed to trying to keep it in a small select group of hallucinogenic.
Do you know what
elitists.
I would like? That it would that the attitude that could come about would be something like going kayaking down a dangerous river. I just live near a river, so I think of that. Or perhaps hang gliding or horse riding. Yeah, probably. Something that is potentially dangerous, very exciting, can be wonderful, but you've got to know what you're doing and you've got to really want to do it, rather than something you just bumble into. And maybe even have training in and know that there are people far better than you. And if you are a beginner, that you would know, an attitude towards the public in this fantasy world that we have in the future, that you would know as someone who'd never taken it, that it was something that other people became expert in, that it was something that you were a novice at, rather than the attitude which is inculcated by prohibition in our young people now, which is, oh, old people don't know anything about it, our parents don't know anything about it, nobody, I don't have any respect for admiration for those people because they don't know about it, we're the young people, we take all these drugs, we know, that sort of thing. Turn that completely around, and that people going into it for the first time would be thinking, wow, here is a big journey ahead. Here's something I'm going to try. I really think in my life I would like this to be part of my life, and I know there are lots of people who've done it more than me, and I'm going to try this and see what it is they're all on about.
My first experience, everybody, I mean, I was growing up in the 60s, so I was very attentive to the counterculture as it was developing. My father was a Nixon guy, and I was going into the Air Force to be a fighter pilot. So, I mean, I was wow. looking at things on both sides. So, well, you know. my first experience, I didn't have any great tutorial or anything. It was a young lady that I had gone to high school with, I had a mad crush on. I never could figure out why it wasn't reciprocated until she told me she was a lesbian, so I felt a little bit better there. But we went out, and she said, listen, have you taken LSD yet? I said, no. I said, you know, read, blah, blah, blah. She goes, well, let's get together. I've got some. And because she recommended it, I thought, okay, cool. And the only preparation she told me was, you know, keep an open mind, don't be afraid, and just let it go. So, and that...
Perfect. I mean, that's perfect. But she's had it before. She knew what
no,
she
had not had it before. This was what she
hadn't. How did she know that was the right advice to give then?
That was the advice that she was given.
Ah, right.
And I think she wanted to do it with me just to have... I mean, we remained friends. I mean, we were very good friends. And I think she just wanted to share it with a good friend and have that experience, her first experience with someone... Who she knew and the like. But no, she was not experienced, neither was I. And it was like, don't be afraid, keep an open mind, and everything is going to work out fine. So you can go from, you know, just minimal preparation like that, or you can go to spending the day before, half of the day before the day you do it, trying to incorporate parameters and, you know, expectations and things of that nature. So you can either, you can oversell it or you can undersell it. But I think it's important that the individual taking it, and I agree with you, taking it outside is absolutely the best. It is the best environment, a beautiful sunny day, take it in the morning, experience nature all day, get a good night's sleep when it's all over with. And
absolutely, we're at one on that, yes.
Well, I'm glad we're at one on that, and I'm looking at the clock here. We've been speaking now for over an hour, and it's gone by very quickly, Sue, and I'm very happy that you joined us here inside the Opium
Den. Oh, not at all. I've really enjoyed it.
And I want to give you the last word, if anything that you'd like to address that we didn't address, anything you want to say before we close it out here. And again, I just want to thank you for spending the time with us. And maybe someday when I get over there or you get over here, we'll hunker down and eat some LSD together.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I'll take you up on that. You must let me know if you're coming over here. I don't fly anymore because of environmental reasons, and so I'm rather unlikely to ever pop up in Florida. So I will have to rely on you coming over here.
Well, I think you can probably, I wouldn't count on it with all my money, but there's a good bet. There's a lot of people that I've yet to meet in my life, and I got to tell you, Sue, you're one of them on my bucket list of people to meet. I want to thank you. You're very intelligent, very, very funny lady, and I appreciate you spending the time with us. I shouldn't say funny. You got a good sense of humor, let's put it that way.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All righty, Sue.
Lovely to talk to you.
Love to talk
Bye.
To you. Bye now. Well, there you have it. Dr. Sue Blackmore, our conversation today inside the Opium Den Library of Interviews, I guess is what I should say. I hope everyone enjoyed this. Dr. Sue Blackmore, a Googler, you can find out a lot about what's going on over in her world in Great Britain. So as we do normally at the end of all of our shows and interviews, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And always keep in mind that when good people obey bad law never changes.